Good morning, everybody, and welcome to Sun Sounds of Arizona. The program is Business World, and I'm Steve Klein. We're going to start today with a couple of interesting articles if you happen to be a gambler. If you're not a gambler, you probably have never heard of the company that we'll be talking about. If you are, you may well have placed a few bets with this company. The first article is from Fortune magazine. It's by Alicia Park, and it's entitled Inside the Deal That Made Polymarket's Founder One of the Youngest Billionaires on Earth. 1 year ago, the FBI raided Polymarket founder Shane Copeland's apartment. Now, the college dropout is a billionaire at the age of 27. In July, Jeffrey Sprecher, the 70-year-old billionaire CEO of Intercontinental Exchange, the parent company of the New York Stock Exchange, sat at Manhattan, an upscale New York restaurant in the financial district, overlooking the sprawling city's skyline from the 60th floor. As a sommelier weaved through the tables pouring wine, in walked Shane Copeland in a t-shirt and jeans, clutching a plastic water bottle and a paper bag with a bagel he'd picked up en route. Sprecher chuckles as he recalls his first impression of the boyish, eccentric entrepreneur, an old bald-headed guy that works at the New York Stock Exchange, where we require that you wear a suit and tie, next to a mop-headed guy in a t-shirt that's 27. But Sprecher was fascinated by Polymarket, Copeland's blockchain-based prediction market, and after dinner, he made his move. I asked Shane if he would consider selling us his company. Prediction markets like Polymarket let thousands of ordinary people bet on future events, the unemployment rate, say, or when Bitcoin will hit an all-time high. In aggregate, prediction market bets have proven to be something of a crystal ball, with the wisdom of the crowd often proving itself more prescient than expert opinion. For instance, Polymarket punters predicted that Trump would prevail in the 2024 presidential election, when many national pundits were sure that Kamala Harris would win. Copeland initially turned down Sprecher's buyout offer, but discussions led to negotiations and eventually a deal. In October, Intercontinental announced it had invested $2 billion for an up to 25% stake in the company, bringing the young solo founder the balance he was looking for. We're consumer, we're viral, we're culture. They're financed, they're headless, and they're infrastructure, Copeland tells Forbes in a recent interview. At the same time, Copeland announced investments from other billionaires, including Figma's Dylan Field, Zynga's Mark Pincus, Uber's Travis Kalanick, and hedge fund manager Glenn Dubin. A longtime Red Hot Chili Peppers fan, Copeland even convinced lead singer Anthony Kiedis to invest after a mutual acquaintance brought the musician to Copeland's apartment one day. He's buzzing my door, and I'm like, and I'll delete the expletive. Copeland recalls, his bright blue eyes widening. I love their music. A lot of the inspiration for my work comes from the music that I listen to. Thanks to the deals, Polymarket's valuation quickly shot to $9 billion, making the 2025 under 30 alum the world's youngest self-made billionaire, with an estimated 11% stake worth $1 billion. His reign was short. 20 days later, he was overtaken as the youngest by the three 22-year-old founders of AI startup Mercor. Young entrepreneurs are minting 10-figure fortunes faster than ever. In addition to the Mercor trio and Copeland, 15 other under 30 alumni, including Scale AI co-founder Lucy Guo, Reddit's Steve Huffman, and Cursor's co-founder, became billionaires this year, while Guo's co-founder Alexander Wang and Robinhood's Vlad Tenev, both former under 30 honorees, regained their billionaire status after having fallen out of the ranks. The budding billionaire has long been fascinated by markets and tech. When he was just 14, Copeland emailed the Regional Securities and Exchange Commission office to ask how to create new marketplaces. I did not get a response, but it's a really funny email, he says, grinning playfully as he thinks of his younger self. It just shows that this stuff takes over a decade of percolating in your mind. 2 years later, Copeland showed up at the offices of internet startup Genius, uninvited after multiple emails of his asking for an internship went ignored. At age 16, at least a decade younger than anyone in that office, he secured his first job after making a memorable impression with his wild curls and encyclopedic knowledge of billionaire tech entrepreneurs. If he chooses to become a tech entrepreneur, which seems likely, I have no doubt that we'll be seeing his name again in the press before long, Chris Glazik, his manager at the time, wrote in Copeland's college recommendation letter. Copeland went on to study computer science at NYU, but dropped out in 2017 to work on various crypto projects that never took off. In 2020, he founded Polymarket to create a solution to the rampant misinformation he saw in the world. The company's first market allowed users to bet on when New York City would reopen amid the pandemic. He soon expanded into elections and pop culture happenings, among other events. But it didn't take long for the company to butt heads with regulators. In January 2022, Polymarket paid a $1.4 million fine to the Commodity Futures Trading Commission for offering unregistered markets. It was also ordered to block all U.S. users, but activity on Polymarket skyrocketed, particularly during the 2024 U.S. presidential election, with bets totaling $3.6 billion. A week after the election, the FBI raided Copeland's apartment and seized his devices as part of an investigation into a possible violation of this agreement. Shortly after, Copeland posted on his X account that he saw the raid as a last-ditch effort from the Biden administration to go after companies that they deemed to be associated with political opponents. In July, the Department of Justice and CFTC dropped the investigations, after which Sprecher reached out to Copeland for dinner. And less than a week later, Polymarket announced it had acquired CFTC Licensed Derivatives Exchange, QCX, to prepare for a compliant U.S. launch. QCX applied to be a federally registered exchange in 2022, an application that was left dormant for 3 years before receiving approval less than 2 weeks before the acquisition was announced. When asked about the timing of the deal, Copeland points to CFTC Acting Chairwoman Carolyn Pham, who President Trump tapped to lead the agency in January. Carolyn deserves a lot of credit for getting every single license that had been paused for no reason approved as acting chairwoman in less than a year, he says. Copeland had realized an acquisition might be the only way for Polymarket to legally operate in the United States. He made this decision as early as 2021 due to the lengthy federal approval process, a source familiar with the deal told Forbes. Just 2 months after the acquisition and days after Donald Trump Jr. joined Polymarket's advisory board, the company received federal approval to launch in the United States. Trump Jr. has also served as the strategic advisor to Polymarket's main competitor, Kalshi, since January. Polymarket's rapid rise has drawn critics. Dennis Kelleher, co-founder and CEO of Washington-based financial advocacy group Better Markets, told Forbes in an email that the current administration's deregulation around predictions market has unlocked a regulatory loophole to enable unregulated gambling under the CFTC, which has zero expertise, capacity, or resources to regulate and police these markets. Kelleher added that with backing from the Trump family, who were directly trying to profit on this new gambling den, the massive deregulation and crypto hysteria will almost certainly end badly for the American people. Investors and businesses are scrambling to seize the moments of deregulation. We had opportunities to invest in events markets earlier, but there was a lot of risk, Sprecher says, listing the regulatory changes in favor of crypto and prediction markets under the current administration. This was the moment to invest if we wanted to still be early in the space. In the last few months, Trump's Truth Social and sportsbook FanDuel, as well as cryptocurrency exchanges Crypto.com, Coinbase, and Gemini, all announced their own plans to offer prediction markets. Robinhood CEO Vlad Tenev said prediction markets, which were integrated into its platform in March, were helping drive record activity for the retail brokerage in its third quarter earnings call. People are starting to realize right now that the opportunities are endless, says Dubin, the billionaire hedge fund veteran who invested in Polymarket earlier this year. He points to sports betting companies, which have been regulated by states as gambling activity and taxed accordingly. States like New York can tax up to 51% of sportsbooks' revenue, but federally regulated prediction markets can bypass state laws, avoiding taxes and operating in all 50 states. With the realization that prediction markets could upend the sports betting industry, which brought in $13.7 billion in revenue in 2024, businesses are quickly jumping on board despite pushback from state gambling regulators. In October, both Polymarket and Kalshi secured partnerships with sportsbook Prize Picks and the National Hockey League, and Polymarket announced exclusive partnerships with sportsbook DraftKings and the Ultimate Fighting Championship. The disruption won't be limited to sports betting. Alongside its investment, Intercontinental's tens of thousands of institutional clients, including large hedge funds and over 750 third-party providers of data, will soon have access to Polymarket data as soon as it gets integrated into Intercontinental's products, such as indices, to better inform investment decisions. It also hopes to work with Polymarket to work on initiatives around tokenization, or converting financial assets into digital tokens on blockchain technology, to allow traders on all Intercontinental's exchanges to trade more flexibly at all hours of the day, Sprecher says. What's more, in November, Google Finance announced it would integrate Polymarket and Kalshi data into its search results, while Yahoo Finance also announced an exclusive partnership with Polymarket. Despite flashy investors, partnerships, and a record $2.4 billion of trading volume in November, Polymarket has yet to launch in the United States or turn a profit. Copeland and his investors have hinted at ways the company could make money one day, selling its data, charging fees to users, launching a cryptocurrency token similar to Ethereum or Bitcoin, but declined to confirm any specifics. For now, the only thing that's certain is the bet Copeland is making on himself. Going for it and having it not pan out is infinitely better outcome than living your life as a what if, he says. Standing across from the New York Stock Exchange building, Copeland tilts his head up as he watches a massive banner with Polymarket's logo get hoisted onto the exterior of the building. It's been 5 years since founding, 1 year since the FBI raid. He's taking it all in. Against all odds, the bright blue banner reads, rippling in the wind against three American flags protruding from the building. Here's another market updating the current status of Polymarket. Again, it's from Fortune magazine by Carlos Garcia, and it's dated December 3rd. Battle for sports betting market heats up as Polymarket announces return to the U.S. The world's largest prediction market platform is returning to the United States. On Wednesday, Polymarket posted on X that users can get on the wait list for its app, saying the company will start by offering sports betting, with markets on everything to follow. Polymarket's impending return to the United States comes at a time when prediction market services, including Kalshi and Robinhood, are challenging the likes of DraftKings and FanDuel for a share of the lucrative sports betting market, while also offering bets on a wide variety of other fields. Polymarket has been banned from operating in the United States, following backlash from regulators in early 2022, when the Commodity Futures Trading Commission found it was offering betting contracts without the agency's approval. The FBI later raided the company founder, Shane Copeland's home, but earlier this year, U.S. prosecutors and the CTFC dropped their investigation, and the company received regulatory approval. Prediction markets, platforms where people can bet on future events, ranging from the size of a Federal Reserve cut to the number of Elon Musk tweets in a given week, have broken into the mainstream. This began in part when Polymarket and its main competitor, Kalshi, correctly predicted President Trump's election victory, contrary to many national polls. Polymarket uses a blockchain network to run its platform, and users can wager either in dollars or cryptocurrency. The startup is reportedly also in plans to launch a token of its own. Polymarket and Kalshi are also valued at $15 billion and $11 billion, respectively. Legacy financial institutions have also embraced the sector. In October, a parent company of the New York Stock Exchange invested $2 billion in Polymarket. Prior to this week, U.S. users who wanted to access Polymarket would have to do so by using a VPN. As a quick aside, don't feel bad if you don't know what a VPN is. I had to look it up myself. Here's the definition. A VPN, or virtual private network, creates an encrypted connection over the internet to protect your data and mask your IP address. It works by routing your internet traffic through a secure tunnel to a remote server, which makes it more difficult for hackers, your ISP, or other third parties to track your online activity, to steal data, or to see your real location. VPNs are used for privacy, security on public Wi-Fi, and to bypass censorship or geo-restrictions. Now back to the article. Meanwhile, Kalshi has had CFTC approval and has been live in the United States since 2021. Sports betting has been mired in controversy of late, as scandals rocked major American leagues like the NBA and the MLB. The cases allege that players like Terry Rozier and Emmanuel Clase manipulated their performance in order to win bettors' money. Critics say that the proliferation of predictions markets could similarly corrupt politics and other institutions. For now, though, prediction markets are charging full steam ahead. Bettors can even place a bet on whether Polymarket will go live in the United States in 2025, where odds are currently at 99%. Now we're going to talk about another company that many of you may not have heard of. However, if you're an online shopper, you almost certainly have heard of it. The company is Temu. Temu is an online marketplace operated by e-commerce company PDD Holdings, which is owned by Colin Huang. It offers heavily discounted consumer goods, mostly shipped to consumers directly from China. By April 2025, the platform had expanded its operations to more than 90 markets. In March 2024, Temu launched its local seller program in the United States. As of July 2025, the program was operational in the UK, France, Italy, Japan, Mexico, and Australia, among other countries. The program is designed to help local sellers reach more local consumers, to bring more locally relevant products to local shoppers, and to improve the user experience. Temu's business model has allowed it to become popular among consumers, but has also drawn concerns over data privacy, forced labor, intellectual property, and the low quality of its marketplace products. The company has been embroiled in legal disputes with Shine, a direct competitor. The rise of Temu is one of Amazon's biggest challenges in years. On October 17th, 2022, Temu emerged as the most downloaded U.S. shopping app. According to Sensor Tower, it was the most downloaded mobile app in any category in the United States between November 1st and December 14th, 2022. According to SimilarWeb, as of September 2024, it became the second most visited online shopping site in the world. As of December of the same year, the number of monthly active users of Temu's global smartphone app surpassed that of Amazon. In the year 2024, it was the most downloaded phone app in over 20 countries. That was the definition of Temu from Wikipedia. Here's the article in question, again, from Fortune magazine and the Associated Press. Arizona becomes the latest state to sue Temu over claims that it's stealing customer data. Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays announced Tuesday that Arizona is the latest state to sue Temu and its parent company, PDD Holdings Incorporated, over allegations that the Chinese online retailer is stealing customer data. Mays said the app deceives clients about the quality of its low-cost products and collects what she described as a shocking amount of sensitive data without the consent of users, including GPS locations and a list of other apps on users' phones. According to the lawsuit, prosecutors are concerned about Temu being subject to laws in China that require Chinese companies to hand over data requested by the government and that its code is designed to evade security reviews. It can detect everywhere you go, to a doctor's office, to a public library, to a political event, to your friends' houses, Mays said during a news conference. So the scope of this invasion of privacy is enormous, and that's why I consider it possibly the gravest violation of the American Arizona Consumer Fraud Act that we've ever seen in Arizona. Arizona's top prosecutor also said the state wants to protect businesses from being ripped off by the online retailer, alleging the company has copied the intellectual property of brands that include the Arizona Cardinals and Arizona State University. In a statement early Wednesday, Temu denied the allegations. "We help consumers and family access quality products at affordable prices," the company said. "We work to keep costs down and to maintain reliable supply so people can meet their needs without stretching their budgets." Attorneys general in Kentucky, Nebraska, and Arkansas have filed similar lawsuits in recent years. There have been legislative efforts at the federal level to counter China's influence, especially when it comes to technology and intellectual property. But Mays suggested that there should be greater intervention by the federal government to protect consumers. Mays called the allegations against Temu more egregious than those that have been made against TikTok. Through a forensic review, investigators in Arizona found the app's code as portions recognized by experts as malware or spyware and allows exfiltration of data from a user's mobile device while concealing that the app is doing so. The review also found in the app large swaths of previously banned code from the platform's precursor version. Mays urged Arizonans to delete their Temu accounts, uninstall the app, and scan their devices for malware. Next is an article about an area of AI's capabilities that you really may not have given much thought to. The title of the article is "How a Tiny Polish Startup Became the Multi-Billion Dollar Voice of AI." It's by Ian Martin from Fortune magazine, dated December 3rd. 11 Labs' computer voices are so convincing that they could fool your mother. That's both a blessing. Its under 30 alumni founders are both now billionaires, and a curse for the four-year-old company. Dubbed films in Poland are horrible. A lone lector delivers all the dialogue in an enervated Slavic monotone. There is no cast, no variation between speakers. Young audiences hate it. Ask any Polish person, and they'll tell you it's terrible, says Mati Staniszewski, the co-founder of AI's speech outfit, 11 Labs. I guess it was a communist thing that struck a cheap way to produce content. While working at Palantir, Staniszewski teamed up with high school friend and Google engineer Peter Dabkowski to experiment with artificial intelligence. The pair realized that one project, a particularly promising AI public speaking coach, could solve the unique Polish horror of Leonardo DiCaprio or Scarlett Johansson being drowned out by a Lecter star like Maciej Gudowski. The pair pooled their savings and by May 2022 had quit their jobs to work full-time on 11 Labs. Out of the gate, their new AI text-to-speech generator was leagues better than the robotic voices of Apple's Siri and Amazon's Alexa. 11 Labs' AI voices were capable of happiness, excitement, and even laughter. In January 2023, 11 Labs launched its first model. It could take any piece of text and use AI to read it aloud in any voice, including a clone of your own, or worryingly, someone else's. There was immediate demand. Authors could instantly spawn audiobooks. With the software, prorates now start from $99 a month for higher quality or more time. YouTube creators use 11 Labs to translate their videos into other languages. Its models can now speak in 29. The Warsaw and London-based startup landed deals with language learning and meditation apps. Then media companies like HarperCollins and Germany's Bertelsmann jumped in. It was obvious that this was the best model, and everyone was picking it off the shelf, says investor Jennifer Lee of Andreessen Horowitz, who co-led a $19 million round in May 2023. A year later, the co-founders were honored as part of Forbes 30 Under 30 in Europe. Others, though, found more unnerving uses. AI sound-alikes of public figures, such as President Trump, crassly narrating video game duels, actress Emma Watson reading Mein Kampf, and podcaster Joe Rogan touting scams quickly went viral. Worse, fraudsters began using AI cloning tools to impersonate loved ones' voices and steal millions in sophisticated deepfake swindles. None of it stopped venture capitalists from pouring in money. 11 Labs has raised more than $300 million in all, soaring to a $6.6 billion valuation in October to become one of Europe's most valuable startups. Staniszewski, 30, who acts as CEO, the firm has no traditional titles, and research head Dabkowski, 30, are both now billionaires, worth just over $1 billion each, per Forbes estimates. Around half of 11 Labs' $193 million in trailing 12-month revenue comes from corporates like Cisco, Twilio, and Swiss recruitment agency Adecco, which uses its tech to field customer service calls or interview job seekers. Epic Games uses it to voice characters in Fortnite, including a chat with Darth Vader with the consent of James Earl Jones's estate. The other half of its revenue comes from the YouTubers, podcasters, and authors who were early adapters. When you talk to them, it's mind-blowing how good they are, says Gartner analyst Tom Koschow. Unlike most AI firms, too, 11 Labs is profitable. Forbes estimates it netted $116 million in the last 12 months. That's a 60% margin. It's now competing against giants like Google, Microsoft, Amazon, and OpenAI to become the de facto voice of AI. It's not a new space. Tech companies started spinning up products to listen, transcribe, and generate speech around a decade ago. While it's somewhat of a sideline for Microsoft, Satya Nadella was willing to shell out $20 billion to buy NASDAQ-listed voice transcription service Nuance in March 2022. OpenAI launched its own voice tool, which can feed human conversations into ChatGPT in October of 2024. But 11 Labs' 300-person team isn't playing catch-up. His models are so good that it's able to get away with charging up to three times as much as its American rivals. Its library of 10,000 uncannily human-sounding voices is largest by far, and now includes A-listers Michael Caine and Matthew McConaughey. It's also more reliable. Data training startups LabelBox tested six of the top voice models with a reading quiz and found that 11 labs made half as many errors as its closest competitor, OpenAI. We're one of the very few companies that are ahead of OpenAI, not only on speech, but speech to text and music. That's hard, Staniszewski says. 11 Labs' recipe is simple. A tight cadre of machine learning researchers with obsessive focus on one narrow problem and a tight budget. The co-founders fronted the first $100,000 training run, and this drove product breakthroughs. Having a ton of compute can be a curse because you don't think how to solve it in a smart way, Dabkowski says. But a lawsuit from a pair of audiobook narrators hints at another ingredient. Carissa Vacker and Mark Boyett allege that 11 Labs used thousands of copyright-protected audiobooks to train its models. They claim so many of their books were scraped that clones of their voices ended up as default options on 11 Labs. The case, in which 11 Labs denied wrongdoing, was settled out of court in November. Voyer and Boyett did not respond to a comment request. 11 Labs declined further comment. Maturity is setting in. The company finally drew up a list of no-go voices, mostly politicians and celebrities. After an 11 Labs-made clone of Joe Biden's voice was used to discourage voting in a robocall campaign around the 2024 Democratic primary. 11 Labs now has seven full-time human moderators, plus AI, naturally, scouring its clips for misuse. Newly cloned voices need to pass a consent check, and the company offers a free deepfake detector. Staniszewski and Dabkowski have big plans beyond voice. Both cash-strapped creators and budget-conscious media companies wanted royalty-free background music, so they delivered an AI music generator in August. You don't have time to shoot a video? 11 Labs will have AI avatars to front Sora-style videos next year. In case you're wondering what Sora is, that is OpenAI's free video service. Their boldest bet is that they can translate their expertise to provide a single hub for clients to manage all their AI tools. We're building a platform that allows you to create voice agents and deploy them smoothly, Staniszewski says. Of course, that puts 11 Labs on a collision course with a gaggle of other startups hoping to do exactly the same thing. It helps that it's been profitable since its earliest days, but its startup competitors are richly funded, and the tech giants have virtually unlimited resources. Still, it must innovate. Voice models will soon be commoditized. When other models catch up, fickle consumers that already balk at 11 Labs pricing will likely switch. As it broadens beyond voices to more computationally intensive music and video, 11 Labs needs to expand its own GPU farms to stay in the race. It's already spent $50 million on a data center project in Oregon. If we're to build a generational company in AI, you need to build scale, and we are building, Staniszewski says. Back in Poland, the aging core of lectors are still in business, for now. Dabkowski hasn't forgotten 11 Labs' original pitch, boasting that his next model will translate and voice an entire movie in one shot. We never give that up on our mission list. Here's a quick article on Bitcoin. It's by Carlos Garcia from Fortune magazine, dated December 3rd. Bitcoin bounces back more than 10% after a brutal week. Bitcoin is known for its volatility, and lately it's living up to that reputation. After a week-long stretch of decline, Bitcoin's price jumped around 11% in the last 2 days alone, climbing to just under $93,000. As a quick aside, Bitcoin had been as high as $125,000. Okay, back to the article. The original cryptocurrency's price hike follows Vanguard's decision to let its customers buy and sell crypto ETFs in a turnaround from its longtime aversion to the sector. Market jitters were calmed by the news that Vanguard was reversing its long-held decision to ban crypto ETFs from its platform, said Russell Thompson, chief investment officer at Hilbert Group. That potentially opens up crypto access to its 50 million brokerage customers. Prior to the surge, the week had started off disastrously for Bitcoin. From Sunday into Monday, the major cryptocurrency dropped 8%, in part because of Japan raising their 2-year bond yield to a 17-year high. That dip punctuated a nearly 2-month-long slide for the original cryptocurrency. 6 weeks after its $126,000 high in early October, Bitcoin plunged 35% to a low of $82,000. Crypto's struggles for much of October and November showed that the sector is often tied to macroeconomic factors. President Donald Trump's tariff threats to China were followed by an October flash crash for crypto, where traders lost $19 billion in assets. And for much of those 2 months, a December rate cut from the Federal Reserve seemed unlikely, pulling investors away from risky assets. The outlook appears to be a bit rosier for those in the crypto industry, as a Fed rate cut now seems likely. The shift in sentiment stems from recent remarks by New York Fed President John Williams, who spoke optimistically about cutting rates. With a Fed rate cut expected at the December meeting, liquidity should remain supportive of risk assets into 2026, Thompson added. As many of you may already know, Fed Chairman Jerome Powell's term ends in May of 2026. So, what's going to happen? Who is Trump going to replace him with? This article is from Fortune magazine. It's by Eleanor Pringle, and it's dated December 3rd. Trump's pick for the Fed chair isn't enough to threaten the central bank independence, says a top economist, especially if Jerome Powell decides to stick around. One of the major questions heading into 2026 is how deeply politics will be allowed to seep through the corridors of the Federal Reserve. This year, President Trump and his cabinet have lobbied for rate cuts and changes to monetary policy, which is not unheard of. However, the White House has also taken more extreme measures, threatening to fire Fed Chair Jerome Powell while insulting him personally, attempting to remove other members of the Federal Open Market Committee, and visiting the central bank's head office amid a tussle over renovation costs. So, looking ahead, analysts are already wondering what a Trump-nominated Fed chair would mean for the central bank's independence. As UBS chief economist Paul Donovan highlighted in a note to clients earlier this week, a chair overly sympathetic to the views of the White House may draw parallels with a partnership between President Nixon and Fed Chair Arthur Burns in the 1970s, which ended in disaster. Burns ultimately faced rebellion within the ranks of the Fed, and the Fed has been showing more independence of spirit in its voting patterns on policy of late, so one should be cautious of reading too much into the actions of a single individual at the Fed, Donovan added. This was a caveat echoed by Bank of America's senior economist, Aditya Bhave, in a briefing with media yesterday, responding to a question from Fortune about risks to the Fed's independence under a new chair. Bhave said the issue almost depends more on what happens with the broader composition of the committee rather than just the Fed chair. He explained, "So we know there's going to be a new Fed chair. We know they're probably going to take Stephen Miron's seat on the board. So in that sense, the leaning of that board from just inserting that person in and taking Miron out doesn't really change that much, assuming they have a similar policy leaning to Miron." The question then becomes, will Powell leave as a governor? Mirren was Trump's chair at the Council of Economic Advisers before replacing Adriana Kugler on the Federal Open Market Committee following her resignation earlier this year. He's expected to be a temporary appointment, serving out Kugler's term expiring next month. And while the spot of Fed chair will be vacated by Powell in May of 2026, his term as a Fed governor does not end until January 2028, meaning he could break with tradition and stay on at the Fed for a few more years, likely to the chagrin of the Oval Office. Powell has been very noncommittal about that, added Bave. There's very little historical precedence for a chair sticking around as governor. It hasn't happened, I believe, in the last 75 years. But he hasn't said he's going to leave. Powell has been a staunch defender of Fed independence in the face of a barrage of criticism from the White House. He was firm in that he wouldn't leave his position if the Oval Office requested it, and added that it wouldn't be legal for an administration to make any such attempt. Our independence is a matter of law, he noted to Bloomberg this summer. Generally speaking, Fed independence is very widely understood and supported in Washington and in Congress, where it really matters. The point is, we can make our decisions, and we will only make our decisions based on our best thinking, based on our best analysis of the data about what is the way to achieve our dual mandate goals and to best serve the American people. Last month, Raphael Bostic, president and CEO of the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta, confirmed he would be retiring at the end of his term in February 2026, representing another hole in the Federal Open Market Committee that Trump could fill with a dovish economist. And there's also a question of Governor Lisa Cook, whom Trump tried to oust from the committee, and who will hear her case against the action in a Supreme Court hearing in January. The White House will be hoping that the legal process will fall in its favor, thus presenting a further opportunity for another appointment of its choosing. I think those questions are much more important if you're thinking about a wholesale shift in thinking at the Fed than just who the next chair is going to be, Bave added. If you take this committee that is so hesitant to allow Powell to even do the next 25 basis points of cuts, for our estimate, there's about 8 of the 12 Fed presidents who don't want to do that cut, either very explicitly or they somewhat would prefer not to do it. If you take this committee and you put them up against a Fed chair that says, you know what, I want to go to 25 basis points, I just don't think that chair can make a lot of progress in that scenario. Now we're going to talk about AI and electricity, and this is a major topic. We've done a number of articles about this on the show in the past. The articles from Fortune magazine dated December 6th. It's by Christopher Hellman. The title of the article is Why America's Power Grid Will Be Able to Withstand the $2.5 Trillion AI Data Center Building Boom. It's by Christopher Hellman, and here's the article. Tech giants want to double AI electricity consumption in 5 years, by enough to power more than 30 million homes. America can do it. Between now and 2030, the giants of AI, like OpenAI, Google, Microsoft, Amazon, and Meta, aim to more than double the computing power dedicated to growing and operating their non-human minds. They currently use about 40 gigawatts of power, enough for 30 million homes. The cost of this ambition will be astronomical, about $50 billion per gigawatt of computing power, built for a total of, get this number, $2.5 trillion over the next 5 years alone. Roughly 80% of that will go to buy GPUs made by the likes of NVIDIA and AMD. The rest, some $500 billion, will provide the energy via new power plants and transmission lines. At the trajectory these hyperscalers are on, Goldman Sachs figures that by 2030, American data centers will consume 500 terawatt hours per year, more than 10% of total domestic electricity. I think we should already be raising the alarm on the potential for facilities to complete construction, but be without power in 2028 and 2029, says Zach Kraus, an analyst at East Daily, a Denver energy consultancy. I hope they don't march into a wall. Some already have. In Oregon, Amazon Data Services has filed a complaint against Berkshire Hathaway subsidiary Pacific Corp, which has refused to provide power to energize some of Amazon's $30 billion in data center investments there in Santa Clara, California. Two 50-megawatt centers developed by Digital Realty and Stack Infrastructure are ready to go, but they can't get electricity until Silicon Valley Power completes $450 million in grid upgrades, not expected until around 2028 or later. Faced with a new demand for 30 gigawatts of power, utility AES in Ohio told developers they had to enter into long-term contracts to buy 85% of the power they want. The queue dropped by more than half to just 13 gigawatts. Amid the doomsday scenarios are optimists. Joseph Majkut, Director of Energy Security at CSIS, writes in a new report that this is a nice problem for the United States to face and overcome. Rapid demand growth should be good news. Despite trade conflicts and macroeconomic uncertainty, the United States is positioned to power more economic growth and strategic industries than we've seen in decades. A lot of people are saying power is the constraint. Increasingly, we believe that is not necessarily true, said Carson Curl, power markets analyst at Enverus in Calgary. He thinks building enough, fast enough, shouldn't be a problem. The initial reaction is one of disbelief, he says, but there's a lot of excess capacity in the market if you locate your project in the right place. Alex Tang of VC firm 50 Years agrees. If a hyperscaler is committed to do it, it's going to happen, says Tang, who's invested in nuclear, batteries, and solar startups. We're one of the most efficient capital markets. We've shifted on a dime and can stand up a massive effort. According to federal data, the U.S. built 40 gigawatts of new power plants in 2023 and is on track to erect 63 gigawatts this year, half of which will be solar panels. Plenty of data center developers are taking the situation into their own hands, building their own power generation on site rather than relying on utility companies to hook them up. These behind-the-meter generators are especially prevalent in Texas, which has its own power grid that isn't subject to federal regulatory oversight, enabling easier permitting. In Abilene, Texas, the Stargate project is being developed by OpenAI, SoftBank, Oracle, and the investment firm MGX. They're building 10 gas turbines to serve as backup power. Unexpected entrants into this space include the big oil companies, which aim to arbitrage the power difference of their low-value gas against high-value electricity. Chevron plans to build 5 gigawatts of gas turbines for data centers by 2027 in the Permian Basin of Texas, where gas is so plentiful that prices at the Waha pipeline hub have gone negative this year. Giant oil companies, which already operate dozens of power plants at their refineries, will be able to lean on vendors for utility-scale turbines. Others face 4-year wait times for big turbines from the like of GE Vernova, Siemens, and Hitachi. So they've turned to other options. Private equity giant Brookfield inked a $5 billion deal with Bloom Energy for their fuel cells that run on gas. Meanwhile, Elon Musk's XAI for its Memphis, Tennessee data center has deployed dozens of smaller gas turbines, around 30 megawatts, procured from Caterpillar subsidiary Solar Turbines. Kirill at Enverus thinks developers will be able to source an impressive 25 gigawatts a year of smaller size gas generators. Natural gas will power about 60% of all this new data center demand, says Goldman Sachs. Such a domestic natural gas building boom is not unprecedented. According to the Energy Information Administration, in 2002, developers added 57 gigawatts of gas turbines to the grid, led by independent power producer Calpine, which subsequently went bankrupt in 2005 due to surging natural gas prices amid tight supplies. The company is now being acquired by Constellation Energy. Demand from AI could even give coal a second life. Usage has ticked up in the past year, as Trump's EPA has proposed to repeal Biden-era anti-coal rules. Officials in Pueblo County, Colorado, recently asked Xcel Energy to delay the closing of two coal plants until replacements have been found. Longer term, a renaissance in nuclear power will also ensure ample electricity. Meta, Microsoft, and Amazon have all contracted for years of power from decades-old nuclear reactors, and Constellation Energy even landed a federal loan guarantee to restart a mothballed reactor at Three Mile Island. New nukes are in the works as well. Westinghouse and Brookfield launched federal backing to build $80 billion of a new AP1000 reactor, while a dozen startups are working on new small modular reactors. Trump's Energy Secretary Chris Wright wants to see nuclear reactors and data centers built on federally owned lands, particularly military installations that could benefit from redundant power supplies in exchange for easy permitting. International energy consultancy Wood Mackenzie forecasts that AI will help find even more energy than it uses. The firm took decades of data on 2,500 of the world's biggest oil and gas fields, then fed it into a proprietary AI. Using integrative modeling, the AI showed how the industry could boost global oil reserves by 500 billion barrels by applying best techniques to newer fields. Likewise, Rocky Mountain Institute says plenty more power can be unlocked, 50 gigawatts or more, by increasing grid efficiencies, upgrading high-voltage transmission lines, and creating so-called demand response programs, where big customers agree to curtail electricity use during times of peak demand. Researchers at Duke University figure that if a data center operator agreed to dial back power use to just 1% of their expected uptime, it would have the effect of giving the power grid curtailment-enabled headroom to the tune of 125 gigawatts. It's easy to be a naysayer. In generations past, bubbles of overbuilding in railroads and fiber optic networks, and even gas turbines took years to absorb and bankrupted plenty of operators. But this isn't subprime lending. The data center building boom is backed by the richest companies and most powerful governments in the world. If they need more electricity to remain dominant in AI and to protect their market capitalizations, they will find a way. It's definitely an understatement to say that the AI space is competitive. Here's an article from a Fortune 500 digest by Allison Chantel, dated Saturday, December 6th, 2025. It's code red inside OpenAI this week, as the longtime leader in the generative AI race feels its lead slipping away. Google, owned by Alphabet, number 7, is mercilessly showing its AI strength under Sergey Brin, who's returned to the company he co-founded to make sure his team crushes the competition. The success of Google's latest Gemini model and the intense competition for business customers are igniting concern even among Sam Altman's most ardent supporters. But anyone who didn't see this coming has not been paying close enough attention. In January 2023, when Fortune's Jeremy Kahn wrote our cover story on ChatGPT's viral launch, he cautioned, "Google and other titans are hard at work on their own AI platforms, and future more polished software could make ChatGPT look like child's play. OpenAI may someday find that, much like Netscape's short-lived browser reign, its breakthrough has opened a door to a future it is not part of. What's more, other well-funded startups are beginning to eat into OpenAI's market share. Some reports show its $183 billion rival Anthropic earned a larger share of enterprise customers. For our latest cover story, Khan sat down with co-founders Dario and Daniela Armati, who are siblings and former OpenAI employees, and they are not shy about the do-or-die moment in AI. Business should care about bringing in cash, not setting cash on fire, right? Dario Amodi told Khan before swiping at OpenAI. Can you buy so many data centers that you overleverage yourself? For Altman, the stakes couldn't be higher, but no one should be rooting against OpenAI either. As our Jim Edwards recently wrote, the global markets are so reliant on AI, and specifically on Altman, to succeed that any serious shortcomings by the most funded private company in history could lead to a financial reckoning. Since we're talking about electric power, let's switch the topic just a bit. This article is from Forbes Daily News. It's entitled, "The second largest city in the United States took a major step toward 100% carbon-free power." Date of the article is December 5th. Los Angeles officially stopped using coal-generated electricity, and beginning next month will instead use power that is generated from turbines with a blend of natural gas and hydrogen. Eventually, the goal is to transition completely to hydrogen, part of the single largest green hydrogen project in the world, according to David Hansen, who manages power projects for the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power. The overall look for carbon-free green hydrogen in the United States, unfortunately, is dim, with a lack of federal support and higher production costs. But the city's experiment is a bright spot. For the final article of the day, we're going to do it quickly. Netflix on Friday announced it had reached a deal to acquire Warner Brothers, including the company's film and television studios and streamer HBO Max, for $82.7 billion, a move that follows a weeks-long bidding war in which the streaming giant beat out Paramount, and Comcast. In a press statement, the company said the cash and stock deal will close after the media giant's TV network business is spun off into a separate division under Discovery Global. Folks, that's all we have time for today. Thank you for listening. This is Sun Sounds of Arizona. The program is Business World, and I'm Steve Klein. See you next Monday at 11.